With a population of over a billion people, China is one of the world's oldest civilizations. It's massive, it's diverse, and it has an incredibly rich history. And in all that history, I'm interested in exploring the question of how the Bible was first translated in China. What were the different challenges people faced? What can we learn from their mistakes and triumphs? We're going to talk about this and more in multiple episodes. I've been wanting to do this for a long time, and I'm excited to share it with you. I'm Andrew Case, and this is Working for the Word. Get into the history of Bible translation in China. I think it would be good to get us oriented on the Chinese language and writing system in general. To do that, we're going to have a conversation with Dr. Jost Zetsche, who has a Master of Arts in Chinese Studies and German Linguistics from the University of Hamburg. He also has a PhD in the field of Chinese history and linguistics. He spent his first years as a professional researching in the field of sinology. For those of you who don't know, sinology or Chinese studies is an academic discipline that focuses on the study of China, primarily through Chinese philosophy, language, literature, culture, and history. Jost also joined the language industry in 1997, and he has led localization projects in many major software, web, and documentation environments. In 1999, he co-founded the International Writers Group. He is an English-German translator, a consultant in the field of localization and translation, and a writer on technical solutions for the translation and localization industry. He's the author of many books and articles, mostly on translation, but the book we're going to be focusing on in future conversations is his book and dissertation, The Bible in China, The History of the Union Version, or The Culmination of Protestant Missionary Bible Translation in China. Like many dissertation volumes, this one is hard to access, unfortunately. So we're going to give a wider audience access to some of the contents through this series so that more people can benefit from the fascinating history of Bible translation in China. How are Chinese and English different?
Well, they're very different in some ways, and they're very similar in other ways. Both are languages that express realities around, the people who speak them and are very adequate in doing that. And I'm saying that because, you know, that's, I think it's always important to kind of take the label of exotic away from languages. No language is truly exotic. Any language just serves the purpose of its speakers and is doing that usually very well. Yeah. And so is English, so is Chinese. But, of course, there are differences. And one difference in particular is, and I think that's probably one that is known to most of your listeners, is that Chinese is a tone-based language, it's a tonal language. So in Chinese, we, of course, in English or German or French or Spanish, use tones also, but we do it on a sentence level. So we go up with our voice if it's a question, or we go down with our voice if it's an exclamation, etc., etc. That's a tone. But in Chinese, the tone is based on the syllable. Chinese only has a few hundred syllables, and why that is, we'll talk about in a second. And since there is such a fairly small number of different syllables, the language developed in a way that by giving those syllables different characteristics, making them tonal, they essentially became fourfold. There's four, or maybe you can say five tones in Chinese that make it, you know, make it clearly different from English. Now, there are languages that have many more tones than that. You know, other South Asian or Southeast Asian languages or languages in South America. It's, you know, it's not a completely unheard of thing that languages have tones, but Chinese is one of the better known languages, I think, that have tones. And that's, you know, for the English speaker or, you know, other European language speaker who starts to study Chinese, that's kind of a hurdle at first, because you have to sort of unlearn the principles of your language to start learning the principle of this language. It doesn't make it necessarily harder or easier, it's just different.
Now, in linguistics, we usually talk about lexical versus grammatical tone. Does Chinese have both? So it changes the meaning of a word or changes the grammar of a sentence based on the tone?
Primarily lexical. So, you know, the any syllable, depending on the tone you put on the syllable, can mean radically different things. However, there's also a syntactical tone, which is much more subtle. I mean, the lexical tone is the primary tone. At first has to make sense, but you can, of course, put a syntactical tone on your, you know, on your language as well. Interestingly, for instance, you will, if you watch on Chinese TV, if you watch people singing, you will hardly ever see that person without subtitles, because the tune of the song is sometimes forcing a different tone of the syllables than as he, if that person or that singer would speak. It becomes very difficult to understand, and that's why subtitles are so important. The other big difference, of course, is the writing system, right? So we in all European languages have an alphabet, and the alphabet is sound-based. But in Chinese, that is not the case. So Chinese does not have an alphabet. Chinese has a writing system that consists of, well, of 60,000 different characters. The 60,000 is a real number, but not a truly used number. So the typical person who reads the paper and speaks fluently and all that uses about 3,500 or 5,000 characters and is familiar with so many characters. The 60,000, you know, those are historical characters that are sometimes very rarely used or, you know, not used at all anymore. But the largest, I actually have a copy of this massive dictionary, 10 volume, massive volumes, tomes dictionary at home. And the last number is like 59,943 or something like that for the last character. So it's a massive amount of characters. And these characters are sometimes very simple. You know, the character for the number one is just the horizontal stroke. And sometimes incredibly complex with, you know, 20 or more individual strokes per character. And that, of course, also for a person who is not used to this kind of writing system seems like a great hurdle. It can also be a real opportunity because in my case, for instance, I love Chinese characters from the first day I studied them. And I love Chinese calligraphy, which is the art of writing Chinese, you know, with a brush and on rice paper, etc. And because of that love, I learned them very quickly. You know, not that I'm particularly talented, but I was really enthusiastic about it. So it's a challenge to, you know, learn all these characters, but it can be a great joy also. But you can imagine that in Chinese schools, so, you know, imagine the teacher rather than teaching 26 letters of the alphabet to an English student, now having to teach his or her students, you know, several thousand characters. And you can see that there is a real difference there.
I would love to know if today they are inventing, if this is all evolving, the character system, if they are inventing new characters for new concepts or new technologies, new words, and who gets to do that, and all of that sort of thing.
So what is being invented is sort of slang terms. That is being done quite a bit. I've been gone from China now for a long time, so I'm not up on the latest slang, but often not particularly clean language. Characters are being combined from other elements of other characters to form new characters, and all of that. There's one story that I particularly love about a character that was invented in the 1930s, so not particularly long ago, and it's one of my all-time favorite stories. It's the pronoun for God. So the Chinese pronouns, with the development of modern Chinese, kind of copied the system of Western systems where there was a masculine and a feminine and a neuter pronoun. In Chinese, this pronoun is always pronounced the same, but it has a different character. For a man, there's a person. For a woman, there's a woman holding a baby, sort of. And for the neuter, there is an ox as part of the Chinese character for the pronoun, it, he, she. In Chinese, long after the first Chinese Bible was translated by foreign missionaries under the guidance of foreign missionaries, a Chinese translator, you know, in the 1930s, came up with a new pronoun that looks like the other pronouns, only he took the man or the woman or the ox out and put in an element for worship. And so this character is pronounced the same, like the other ones. And everybody who saw that knew that immediately and immediately understood that this is referring to spirituality in some way. And in this case, it was to the persons of the Trinity. And to me, this is such a meaningful story because it is a story where we Westerners, or we from people from anywhere, often tend to associate God with, you know, a male or masculine attributes. And, you know, and of course, in the Old Testament and the New Testament, that is happening often, not just by the pronoun, but by God being a warrior, God being whatever. But there's also other stories in the Bible where God is compared to a mother hen, or God is compared to, you know, definite feminine properties, but we can't say it. We have to use the pronoun he when we refer to God. Now, Chinese doesn't. Chinese has a pronoun that refers just to God, just to him being a deity. And that's that's part of the genius of the Chinese language, that something like that is possible. No other language that I'm aware of. I'm aware of languages where God is she, for whatever reason, but I'm not aware of any other language in the world that was able to express the deity of God by coming up with a new word and a non-artificial word, a word that was immediately understood by users without having to being told what this was about. That's pretty smart.
That's fascinating. Mm. Yeah. Now, in other countries like France, you have what some people call the language police, or the general delegation of the French language. Is there something like that in China?
There is indeed, yes. There's a Chinese academy also, just like the French academy or the Spanish academy there is. And they try to be very controlling, as you can imagine. And yes, there is. And, you know, of course there is, you know, we're in the middle of a pandemic still, where lots of new words had to be coined and had to be formed. Mm. And there's an ad hoc formation of words, and then there is, usually at some point after the ad hoc formations. Usually there's a number of terms for one reality or one entity being developed, and then some authority, in the case of China, an authority decides then which term is the term that should be used.
And does that involve also the creation of new characters?
Very rarely. Mm-hmm.
So they've already got enough to work with.
It's got enough to work with. Yeah, it does have enough to work with. And okay. And it you know, in fact, in if you go to Hong Kong and Taiwan and then to the People's Republic, you will see slightly different writing systems. In the People's Republic in the 1950s, after the revolution, they instituted a language reform by simplifying many of the characters, and sometimes greatly simplifying the characters, and sometimes also simplifying two different original characters to one simplified character.
Yeah. Now, just a practical question that maybe a lot of people don't know. So if you're translating a Bible using Chinese characters on a modern computer and you only have so many keys on your keyboard, how do you manage all of those thousands of characters? How does that work?
A few years ago, it would have been a really complex answer there, because it was, you know, the systems you actually had to install, you know, special software that runs on top of your operating system that allowed you to then enter through various systems, enter characters that were then via your operating system put into your Word document or whatever. And that has changed today. So today, no matter what operating system you're using, whether you have a Macintosh computer or a Windows PC or, you know, Linux or whatever, there are a number of integrated input methods. Those input methods follow a number of different principles. The most common and most widely used principle of entering Chinese characters into a computer document is by using a pronunciation system called Pinyin. Pinyin was developed in the 60s or 70s, and it's a standardized way of writing Chinese characters with Latin characters.
Oh, okay, like a transliteration.
A transliteration, exactly. And the way, like I said, there's only so many syllables for, you know, many different words. And the way it works is with a system that looks for greatest likelihood of the, you know, three-letter code, the P-I-N, right, you might have entered. It shows you then the characters that are all pronounced pin in the many different tones, according to a number of occurrences. And if you then, you know, typical length of a Chinese word is two characters. And so if you then start to write the pronunciation of the next syllable, which would be the next character, you then narrow it down to just a few possibilities. And each of these characters then is displayed on your screen associated with a number. And you, if you say, well, it's the third option, you press three and it then enters that. Sounds complicated, but in reality, it goes incredibly fast. And Chinese typists are amazingly fast and very, very, very efficient. So when I lived in China in the late 80s, they, of course, didn't have computers, and they still used typewriters, which looked crazy because they essentially were crane systems that took out the lead. Is it a type? Anyway, it had, you know, thousands of those little pieces there, and the typists, the, you know, who were schooled, of course, knew exactly where to find those with a little crane and pick them up and got them over to the paper and push them on the paper, put them back in the place, and then to the next one and to the next one. Just very complicated and not very efficient, I might say, even though they were very skilled in what they did. But today with computerized typing, it's very efficient, and you know, whether it's texting or typing a Word document or entering text on a website or wherever, it's very efficient. And like I said, it's, you know, if you have a Windows PC or a Macintosh, it's a matter of 2 minutes to install that input method editor on your computer, and you can start typing.
That's really interesting. Now, going back, let's come back and revisit this, but I still want to ask a couple questions about tone.
Yeah.
Could you give us some examples of where tone would change, you know, like a word where it might have another meaning in a different tone, how that would sound.
So, you know, the example that everybody is always quoting or always using is if you have the syllable M-A, ma. So you imagine you have that syllable ma, the four tones would be, the first tone is a tone that is slightly above your regular speaking level, but it's constant, so it's ma. The second tone is as if it's a question, ma. The third tone is first falling and then going up again, ma. And the fourth tone is just falling, ma. So ma, 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 ma are the four different tones that are associated with that syllable. And, you know, as an example, the first would be mother, ma. The second would be hemp. The third one, ma, is horse. And the ma is to curse. So very different meanings, very different words. And in all those cases, one syllable words, which is the primary way of using Chinese in, you know, for literary Chinese and classical Chinese today, mostly words are two or more syllables.
Now, going back to characters, the writing system, this is really ancient, right? So how ancient are we talking about?
The first occurrences of Chinese characters go back 4,000 or 5,000 BC.
Wow.
And there's a couple of really interesting things about it. One is that, like we already discussed, the characters don't carry sound. There are ways to kind of recognize sound, but they're not obvious. So a character could theoretically have any kind of sound, which is one of the reasons why the dialects in China can be so different, but they all use more or less the same writing. But another thing is that Chinese who or Chinese speakers who can look at documents that were written 2000 BC or 500 BC or, you know, 280 and recognize these characters as if they're written today. Now, there might be some unknown characters to them and they most likely will have a slightly different meaning, but they can still read them. And that is really important for understanding why I think in the Chinese mind, history is really important because it seems really accessible. You know, when we look at a text that was written, you know, I mean, English texts don't go back that much. But, you know, if you look at a text written by Chaucer, it's really hard for us to make sense of it because the spelling, etc., is so different, right? Because he also used a sound-based spelling. And that is just not a hurdle in Chinese at all. So if you go to a museum or to, you know, some stele with some historic inscription, you can look at it and feel an immediate connection to it.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. There are vast differences between classical and modern Chinese, and yet the characters are the same. You know, they might have changed the meaning, certainly have changed the grammar, etc., but they are still recognizable, and more likely than not, you can, you know, pronounce them and come up with some kind of meaning, that which might not be the accurate meaning necessarily, but it's still accessible, and which is really interesting. Yeah. Also, interestingly, because of those of that quality of the Chinese character, China was the dominant culture in its cultural sphere for, you know, hundreds of years, and because of its dominance, many countries and languages or cultures surrounding China took over the Chinese writing system. In Korea, they did. In Japan, they did. In Vietnam, they did. You know, used that system, even though their language was completely different, not even related. But they used the Chinese characters to write their language, since there is no sound connected with it, with a Chinese character. The British and Foreign Bible Society, which was the first Bible society established, I think, in 1802, when they realized that, they misunderstood the situation and thought, ah, if we translate the Chinese Bible, we will have immediate access not only to China and the many provinces of China, but also Japan and Korea and Vietnam and maybe countries that we don't even know of yet. And so that the Chinese Bible was incorrectly assumed to be the key to everything, the key to East Asia.
I see.
So it's really interesting, kind of a historical misunderstanding, but you can see how that misunderstanding came about.
So let's get into verbs, the verbal system in Chinese. What is that like?
Because characters cannot be conjugated or declinated, meaning there is no morphology in Chinese. Morphology means that if you say, I go, he goes, and then you go into the past tense, it's he went and I went, etc. So the verb, in this case, irregular, often regular, changes by changing the endings or prefixes or sometimes the root of the verb even. That Chinese can't do that. So in Chinese, much of the grammar is done by syntax. So the position of the word within a sentence is really important and carries potentially more meaning than in languages that can depend on conjugation and declination more. So for instance, my language, German, we use conjugation and declination much more heavily than English. We have very loose syntactic rules, right? Because the speaker and listener, by looking at the way that the morphology of a verb or any kind of word is being done, can recognize the belonging of the word with other words. So he can see or she can see that if the verb is conjugated in such and such a manner, it must refer to this part of the sentence or to that part of the sentence. In English, we are not conjugating and declinating very much. We do to some degree, but not nearly as much as we do in, say, Russian or German or Hungarian or whatever. So English has more strict syntactic rules. Chinese has even stricter syntactic rules. Chinese is also much context-based. So you, for instance, recognize from the context whether something is plural or singular, for instance, or whether something is happening in the past or in the present or in the future. And then there are particles that that are being used in Chinese that also indicate tense or can indicate plural, singular, and all of that. But generally speaking, Chinese is much more context-based, and Chinese has stricter syntactical rules to govern so that by the position of the word in a sentence, the meaning is often indicated more strongly than in other languages.
So it has strict word order.
Uh-huh.
Okay, right. So it would be the opposite of Greek.
Yeah, in that exactly. Sense.
Now, moving on to punctuation, what is that like? You know, different languages have different ways of doing punctuation from ancient times or not doing it. Did Chinese have punctuation to begin with? Did it develop later? How does that work?
Yeah, it didn't have. I mean, like most languages, it didn't have punctuation to begin with. And really not until the 18th, 19th century was there any punctuation to speak of. There were some rules that governed so Chinese is traditionally written from right to left and top to bottom, and certain words, so for instance, if the emperor would be mentioned in the text, there had to be a line break there. So the emperor always to be on the very top of, if the word emperor or the name of the emperor would be used, he had to be at the very, very top of the page. And so, you know, sometimes you see things like that, but punctuation is a relatively new invention, and actually missionaries in Bible translation did quite a bit to help with punctuation. Okay. They invented a number of punctuation marks that are still being used today, etc.
Well, great. So you've already touched on the genius of the Chinese language. Are there other elements that are in that phrase or in that what makes Chinese extra special kind of category?
Well, I think one thing that presented difficulties to Bible translators, for instance, was its richness. As far as its historical wealth and its long history that was accessible through literature and through, you know, through writing.
Yeah.
So when the missionaries came to China and started to, you know, work with Chinese to translate Christian literature, including the Bible, that was almost too much of a wealth to find sometimes.
Yeah.
And caused a lot of problem, where, you know, different groups of missionaries very, very strongly disagreed on what words should be used to describe what reality or what concept or,
sure,
you know, the passion with which these questions were discussed and argued about in China and outside of China about certain words, important words in Bible translation, that was unique. And there was no other culture, I think, where you had that kind of long-standing argument that, in fact, is still continuing today, not as an argument per se, but as different versions of the Bible with different words being used for God and baptism and spirit. And, you know, those three words in particular were much argued about. So you have not only different Protestant and Catholic versions of the Bible with different words for those realities, but also different Protestant versions, you know, and,
right,
and several of those. that makes it unique, I think. Today, I think that that's also a generalization, but I think many Chinese Christians might say today, what a wonderful situation that we have such a wealth of, you know, we don't just have one word for God, we have two words for God. Uh-huh. That's such a privilege to have. Well, that was not seen as a privilege necessarily when the missionaries, you know, thought about it. And that was seen as something that they needed to be right. And,
yeah. So thanks for joining in on this conversation. There's a lot more interesting stuff in store, so stick around for the next episode. Working for the Word is a podcast where we believe that the Bible is a unified, God-breathed, God-centered, hope-giving book, sweeter than honey and pointing to Jesus. This podcast exists to help us all treasure the Bible more, go deeper into it, and become like the man of Psalm 1.